So today, I'll talk about what I was going to talk about on Friday. So the topic of today's lecture is Kaluza-Klein theory. The purpose of the handout is because there's sort of quite a bit of algebra going on the board. And rather than have you worrying about copying things down correctly, it's better to just have a version in front of you so you know you've got the material, so you can instead focus on kind of watching the, you know, the logic of the argument and trying to sort of pick up what's going on rather than getting all the details down. So sure, the details are important when you have to do a calculation or if you want to understand the detail, you know, what's going on, but in terms of meeting it and understanding the rationale, it's better not to waste time getting all that right. So the idea, I think you met Kaluza-Klein briefly, I think, in the introductory GR course. I have the idea. I'm sure I saw it on a list of lecture titles. But I'm not sure whether it was something which was more done in a schematic format or whether it was something that was done in detail. And I think that given that in modern gravity usage, apart from things like, so basically GR gets used either in very practical applications such as, you know, gravitational wave astronomy or actually computing things like mergers, black hole mergers or binary star mergers. The counterpoint of that, which is very hands-on, but since you're not getting a numerical relativity course, it's not a direction in which I thought perhaps to focus so much this time. The other main way in which you use and work with gravity is tends to be things where you are using gravity not necessarily in four dimensions. And so you have more than four dimensions. I think when I've been talking about manifolds, I was careful to keep it general. And I've also, you've done tutorials on higher dimension or higher dimensional black holes, I think. So the idea here is to put it into some sort of context. We think there may be extra dimensions in nature. We don't know for sure, because of course they haven't been measured. But if there are, there has to be a way of actually hiding them. Because as far as we're concerned, we have three spatial dimensions and one time. And so one way of hiding extra dimensions is to make them very small. And so that's Kaluza-Klein theory. And what we're going to do today is to look at the simplest example of Kaluza-Klein theory, one extra dimension, and to see in detail how the degrees of freedom of gravity in five dimensions translate into degrees of freedom in four dimensions. So we'll just see that in detail. And I think it's useful to see it in detail at least once so that then, you know, if you need to go on and do more sophisticated applications, you've got the groundwork in place. So what Kaluza and Klein did way back, it's nearly a century ago now, was they made a fairly simple type of observation that if we looked at geometry in five dimensions, somehow inside five-dimensional geometry is four-dimensional geometry, so our usual gravity, maybe, plus some extra parts. So I've already tried to motivate using scalar fields in gravity by saying that an extra dimension might have a size, and so that's a scalar field. But also you could have a velocity or some cross term in the metric in the extra dimension. And so that would be interpreted as a single vector field. And so you have something that looks like normal geometry, something that looks like a scalar, which they essentially didn't consider, and then something that looks like a single covector. So that looked like possibly a gauge field. And so they then went through and computed what the Einstein action in five dimensions and saw that it looked like Einstein-Maxwell theory in four dimensions. And so it was a very nice unification of electromagnetism and gravity at least with certain caveats. So it's kind of completely the opposite of gauge unification in some ways. It's sort of very geometric and, of course, very, very classical. So let's just look at thinking about what that means. We have a five-dimensional metric. Let me just write it down in a particular way. So a five-dimensional metric, my mu and nu here are going to be my space-time indices. So this psi is a fifth dimension. And so as long as I don't say what g, sigma, and a depend on, that's a completely generic five-dimensional metric. All I've done is split up the components in a particular way. So I've chosen, as advertised, to take the G phi 5 component. This I've written as e to the 2 sigma. And so sigma is going to be my scalar field. So this is representing an overall size of the psi field here. Now, again, in general, I'm going to have cross terms. So this, which is sort of g5 mu up to a factor. So this is my cross term. And since it has one space-time index, it looks like a covector field. And then what remains, I've made this total square for convenience. And what remains is what I'm going to identify as a four-dimensional metric. So at the moment, I haven't said what those fields depend on, okay? So this is not Kaluza-Klein theory as yet. However, if I imagine that my fifth dimension is not infinite but compact, so and then I'm going to have a notion which, of course, with the scalar field is perhaps slightly bogus, but a notion also of it being small, then I can start to ask, how do I decompose the degrees of freedom of this metric with respect to the space-time coordinates and the psi coordinates? I should have brought my umbrella in, actually, shouldn't I? It's getting worse. So what we're really doing here is, because we're imagining now psi as some compact direction, and we're also thinking of it as being in some intuitive sense small, we could say that we would imagine a big picture might be that G, sigma, and A depend only on the four-dimensional coordinates. But then we could just do a Fourier decomposition of our degrees of freedom with respect to the fifth dimension. So we're simply saying we've got, so whatever the periodicity is, we we might have modes like this. So that's the basic idea. And then if our fifth dimension has a very small periodicity, we would then look at our, you know, gosh, it's coming all the way that long now. We would then look at our sort of the degrees of freedom, G, sigma, and A, and these Fourier modes can be interpreted from a four-dimensional perspective as mass terms. And if L is small, the mass is large. And so if our masses are high, we expect that our low energy limit will simply be the zero mode, or the one which has no dependence on our extra dimension. So that's the idea of Kaluza-Klein theory. So our physics is dominated by this zero mode. So that's what I'm now going to look at. G mu nu depending only on x, sigma and a depending only on x. So our Einstein action is the Ricci scalar, and so we have to calculate the Ricci scalar of that metric. So I'm going to use that, the Cartan formalism, because we've worked hard at trying to derive it and to learn about how to use it. And so as is familiar, I'm simply saying that I have an orthonormal basis for G, so I'm going to be sort of carrying through just generic expressions for G in terms of the spin connection and the curvature two forms. And then that's, you now see the reason, if you like, for me explicitly making the expression of my metric look block diagonal. So I can read off what my final fifth one form is. So I can then, next step is to differentiate these. So, if I differentiate, the first term, since it's just the basis for G, simply gives me the normal spin connection. And the second term, when I differentiate omega 5, I get something which is the derivative of sigma and something which is dA. So I'm now saying that F is dA. So at the moment, I'm not actually saying that's electromagnetism, but the fact that we're getting something that looks like the Maxwell tensor is at least promising. Now, in this case, I can't quite so straightforwardly just read off. So normally when when we have block diagonal metrics that you can automatically read off the spin connection. But in this case, I have to just be a little more circumspect. So I look at this part, and I can see that I can pick off immediately this derivative of sigma. So that part is easy. Then this second term, f here, is a half fab omega a cross omega b. So I have to put in here plus a half fab omega b e to the sigma. So that's okay, but then when I come to picking off the space-time parts, I can't just leave it as theta naught AB, because remember, d omega A is equal to theta AB cross omega B and a theta A5 cross omega 5. So theta A5 cross omega 5 will not pick up that term, but it is going to pick up a term here, which is not present in that expression. So I also have to take, to make this work, I've also got to add an F term to the space-time part of the connection. So that's just, this is an example where you can't simply easily read things off. So now, if I look at calculating the curvature two forms, I've got three parts. So I take d of theta AB. So I've got to differentiate theta naught and e to the sigma f omega 5. So I'm just doing each piece in turn, and I just computed d omega 5. Then I've got to take theta cross theta. Oh, this is getting ridiculous. I'm rained on here. I'm going to write it all down for completeness, but as you can see, I'm not going to necessarily use it all. Oh, no, that term doesn't contribute. Right, so the final piece is the theta A5 cross theta 5B. Read the thing. Right, so sorry about that. It's a little artificial dancing around the raindrops. So I'm not really going to go through trying to simplify it because I'm looking to calculate the Einstein action, which means I want the Ricci scalar. In order to get the Ricci scalar, I'm obviously summing the Ricci tensor. And so I only ever want pieces of the Riemann tensor, which are either have all space-time indices, i.e. all 0 to 3, or have two space-time and two 5 indices. So obviously, this term and that term are going to contribute to the space-time part of the Riemann tensor. But given that I've already got two space-time indices here, I'm not really interested in something with one space-time and one fifth index, because that's not going to contribute to the Ricci scalar. So I have to go and identify things in here that have only two space-time indices. So anything with an omega 5, I can ignore. So here's something that's not got an omega 5 in it. And this last piece doesn't. So I think that's it. Got to be more than that. Okay. Let me just have a look at the F terms. They're both got factors of e to the 2 sigma. So this, the first one, remember F is a half FAB omega A cross omega B. So there I've got those terms. And then the other term, which is the final one down there, is got FAC FBD. And then I have to make sure that it's anti-symmetric on the C and D indices. So that's why I've taken that particular combination. So although it was slightly lengthy writing down what RAB was, just extracting the information that I need has made it relatively quick to find the parts of the Riemann tensor that I'm going to be looking for. So that's half the work done. Now let me look at the other half. So here it's, there's fewer terms, so there's less algebra to do. All I've got to do is just differentiate that first one, the connection one form up there, the theta 5a. So I've got there sigma. Got to differentiate in the first piece, I've got to differentiate the sigma, and then I do the omega 5. So that's the first part of d theta 5a. The second part is differentiating the e to the sigma FAB omega B term. So now the reason I'm not actually going to do that in gory detail is because everything there depends on just space-time. It's got already got a space-time one-form omega b, and when I take derivatives of any of these terms, e to the sigma is just going to give me another space-time one-form, FAB similarly, and d omega b. So this term here is going to be of the form omega b cross omega c times some components. And as I said, what I'm trying to do is extract what I need for the Ricci scalar. And if I've got one index being a 5 and one being a space-time, I just want a 5 and space-time index. So I don't need to look at that any further. I'm just not interested in it. So that's taking care of the first piece. And then the second term. So, for the second term, I'm simply writing down what theta 5b is and theta ba. So again, what I need to do here is to extract something which has a 5 index and an a index. So for example, this is space-time and the fifth dimension, so that gets picked up. So is this. This doesn't. This doesn't. And then on the bottom line, I've got here this omega 5 is going to pair with the first term. So I'm going to take this and this. And so here I get one of those and one there. Then I'm not interested in that cross term. And this one gives me zero anyway. So it's the second times the second. So that's going to tell me what I need to extract. So that's what I'm looking for. So the first term is my second derivative of sigma. The second term is two first derivatives of sigma. Then I've got a term which is sigma with here with a connection component. And then finally, I've got an FF term from that. Ow. Okay, so I've extracted the parts of the Riemann tensor that I need. So now I can go ahead and calculate the Ricci tensor. So here I'm simply contracting over the space-time indices. And then for the space-time part of the Ricci tensor, I take, first of all, I contract the space-time part of the Riemann tensor. And then, of course, I've got to remember to add this term as well. So you can see that if I can track that, those Riemann components, I get an R naught. I'm also picking up, so I'm contracting on A and C, and so I pick up an FF term, and then I get, from here, I get the second derivatives of sigma, and also another FF term. So this tells me if I add them together. That I end up with something that's looking a bit like an Einstein-Maxwell action. And I guess I can write this as minus 2 e to the minus sigma box, e to the sigma, so I can do that. So if I put that together and say, what is my five-dimensional action? So the determinant of that metric over there is e to the sigma root g, and then I've just computed my five-dimensional Ricci. So what I've got, this last term is actually total derivative. So what I end up with is something that really does look very much like four-dimensional Einstein-Maxwell theory. So this was the observation of Kaluza and Klein, that this low-energy effective theory gave me four-dimensional gravity coupled to something that looked like an electromagnetic field. But of course, they essentially fixed the size of the internal dimension, so they fixed the scale of sigma. Yep.
So, when we compute the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar, we only clear out those statements.
Yeah.
So, I don't think why they are.
So, Sorry, why?
I don't get why you confuse RSS.
Five.
Five, five.
Oh,
Yeah.
So, why do we need to that?
Because we need the five-dimensional Ricci scalar. So I have to sum, I've got, in calculating my five-dimensional Ricci scalar, I've got to sum over all the five-dimensional components. So I need R5, 5 as well as the R0, R11, R22, and R33. So I've got to calculate it, I can't ignore it. But I'm just saying that my R5 is expressible in terms of R4, and the exterior derivative of that cross term, the AMU piece. So
when we compute the Ricci scalar, is it wrong that we simply, since I suppose Ricci scalar is simply the from the, you know, since we have got the space-time, the Ricci tensor in the space-time dimension, so. Okay,
so I'm not sure what the question is, so, but basically, all I've done here is I've computed the five-dimensional curvature two forms, and I've been rather lazy. I haven't bothered simplifying them. I've simply pulled out the parts that I need to calculate the five-dimensional Ricci tensor, and then I've calculated the five-dimensional Ricci scalar. And so what I wanted to do is to look at this from an action point of view, and I've expressed the five-dimensional Ricci scalar as a four-dimensional Ricci scalar. And so, you know, that's the process. So this tells me that in terms of
Is this meant to be the same as equation 26? Because the
is there a difference? It probably is. Probably just typo.
I was just wondering if the E sigma at the front should be there.
Sorry?
The extra, like, E sigma.
In this last term?
Yeah, on the right-hand side. Just because it's not in the notes, I was wondering.
Or maybe it's missing from the notes. So let me have a look at the notes after. It's possible there's a typo in the notes. So I'm very sure this e to the sigma should be here, because the determinant of the five-dimensional metric over here is equal. That's another reason for having split the metric in this way. If you compute the determinant of this, you'll see that it's the determinant of g times this factor here. So the square root definitely gives me the e to the sigma. So we'll have a look at the notes. I think it's possible as if it's there.
It's here. You should be looking at equation 29. 26 is just r without the square root of g in front of it.
Okay, I didn't realize that g here was a g4. So it was g5. Okay.
Okay. So that was the observation of Kaluza and Klein, that five-dimensional gravity, so let me write it down explicitly, five-dimensional gravity is equal to 4D gravity plus a Maxwell field if sigma is constant. But here, if these modes do not depend on psi So that's the, I'll put a twiddle there actually, because it's really a low energy effect of action, this thing. So I want to just make a couple of comments about this expression before, you know, doing another final little tweak on it. What I want you to notice is the fact that when you integrate out over the extra dimension, you get a factor of L. So I find that I've actually got to identify my Newton's constant as equaling my five-dimensional gravitational constant divided by L. So here's an example where the gravitational constant, Newton's constant, is now looking more like a derived quantity. It's coming from something which is higher dimensional times something which is telling you about the volume of the internal dimensions. So that's kind of an important lesson. So remember I said something about GN being a derived quantity. So you can see that dimensionally this is correct, because in our Newton's constant, if we set h bar and c equal to 1, has dimensions of length squared. A five-dimensional Newton's constant has dimensions of L cubed, and you're dividing by length. So that's all nice and consistent. So that's the first thing to notice. And then the second thing to notice is, of course, that really, if you do this consistently, you have this scalar degree of freedom. So Klein fixed this extra degree of freedom, but it was rapidly realized if you were applying this theory in practice, cosmologically, it would be disastrous, because, of course, in cosmology, things tend to want to evolve in time. And so you end up with a problem that this scalar field either wants to sort of crunch the extra dimension up so you get a singularity, or else it wants to expand like the rest of the universe, in which case you open up your internal dimension. So the other thing is that, of course, it really is scalar tensor gravity. And so that has its own associated problems. So we've already seen how to, we've discussed conformal frames, so it's often conventional, and I'll just simply quote the transformation. So in this case, the relevant conformal transformation factor is omega is e to the minus sigma on 2. And then if you write phi is sigma on root 3, and you go through that conformal transformation process that we did last week, then you're led to the Einstein frame action being this L over 16 pi g. So I'm simply writing that down just to illustrate that's conventionally how people express the Kaluza-Klein theory. So what I want to just finish off with is I want to talk about black holes in Kaluza-Klein theory, because there's sort of, again, some of the ingredients about what happens or the way you construct black holes tend to crop up more generally. So now, relativity, we always, one of the things that we get told when we first meet relativity is the word, the relativity. It's saying that all inertial observers are equivalent, there's no preferred rest frame, no absolute time, no notion of simultaneity, et cetera, et cetera. And then it seems as soon as we actually go out and start applying Einstein's gravity practically, we're often sort of confronted with preferred frames. So the typical example is cosmology. In cosmology, our universe has a preferred rest frame. So it's one in which the microwave background is homogeneous and isotropic around you. And Kaluza-Klein compactification is another example where there's a definite rest frame. So when I wrote down this metric over here at first, I said that it was a general way of writing down a five-dimensional metric. Correct. It's also true that if I wanted to just single out a particular direction, then I can always do so. So I could say I've got, for example, in three-dimensional space, I could pick a surface, any surface, and then I would say, okay, this surface is z equals zero. And then I define a new surface by integrating out along geodesically along a normal to my surface. Say I integrate out one little step, and that's a new surface, saying z equals one unit, and so on and so forth. Now, I may not be able to do that over the whole of my manifold, because of course we typically don't have global coordinate charts, but I can certainly do it in a neighborhood. So it gives me a choice of coordinates. So what that means is if I pick proper distance as a choice of coordinate, it's saying that I'm picking a proper distance dx5 here. I've got no cross term, and then I'm just throw everything else into some big mush over here, which is the space-time metric. So why is this A really not just something that is irrelevant? Okay, so well, first of all, it is gauge, because it is, we're interpreting it as a gauge field, and we're only ever looking at its derivative, the field strength. But more than that, once you, that's okay if I have an infinite extra dimension, then I can always gauge that field away. But if I make my extra dimension finite, I then do pick a preferred rest frame. So the way of seeing this is simply thinking of T and X5 and saying if I compactify in X5, so I pick my X5 to be finite, what that means is I'm picking X5 here at L, and I'm identifying this point here with this point here. That's my identification. So I'm wrapping this round and making a cylinder. So here, these two points are identified. Once I've done that, then a Lorentz transformation is distinct. So my Lorentz transformation is some T prime and some X5 prime. So my identification here is not with x5 prime equals L and x5 prime equals 0. This point here is identified with this point over here, which has, so this point here has T primed equals 0 and some non-zero x5 prime, and this point here actually has a non-zero T primed and a non-zero, a different X5. So it's definitely not true that this is now just a, that this Lorentz transformation is just some gauge. It actually means something. So our rest frame is where a single coordinate is identified at constant time, or and constant y, z, etc. And so our motion then in that internal dimension is going to have an interpretation of charge because we're generating some a mu, and so we can expect to get charged black holes, Kaluza-Klein charged black holes. So the first thing to do is to use this fact about the Lorentz transformations and simply say, let's boost in that x5 direction before identifying, and that should give me a charged black hole. So I take my Schwarzschild metric, so the first thing is from our statement or this general observation we made about the, when we were discussing building metrics, our building blocks, is that this is taking the black string so our simplest Kaluza-Klein black hole is the Schwarzschild metric in four dimensions simply cross an extra direction. So we've got a solution there, which is known as the black string. And then we boost it, and then we identify. And so that's all I've done here. And I'm just going to show you how that does have an interpretation as a charged black hole. So what I've done here is I've multiplied out that Lorentz transform black string. I've then grouped together my deep psi pieces. So you can see that I've got 1 over 1 minus v squared here. And I've got the Schwarzschild potential times v squared over 1 minus v squared. And so I pull that together. And I re-express that as just the e to the 2 sigma part. So I've pulled out what the d psi squared part is. So then I complete the square. So I look at the cross terms from both of these and complete the square here. That's what I've done. And then I simply take the remaining parts, the express, I've got a dt squared piece here, and then I've already taken a dt squared piece there, and then I'm left with that potential. That's what I've done. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. So V's just meant to be a velocity. So I now just tweak this. So what I want to do is I'm looking at this part here, and I see I've got two, first of all, I've got this combination with this radial coordinate, 1 minus v squared r plus 2mg v squared. So that crops up both with the potential in front of GTT as well as in that gauge part. So this strongly suggests I need to just shift the origin of my radial coordinate. So I do that so that this is going to look like 1 over r hat. And here, that tells me that my A, which is the gauge field there, is simply Q over r hat dt. So that's now looking like a standard electric potential. Then, I guess, here I can see that I've got this r hat divided by r, so I can read off my e to the 2 root 3 phi. So here this is actually just vq, so r hat is r plus vq. So I've picked off what my scalar field is. Because that was my whole point of saying there, talking about the Kaluza-Klein black holes and saying if you do a Lorentz boost, once your extra dimension is compact, that is distinct from the, you know, the boosted frame is distinct from the rest frame. In the rest frame here, you're only ever identifying x5 with x5 plus l, and all the other coordinates do not participate. In the boosted frame, the identification is more complex. You're identifying two, you know, a particular value of t primed and x primed with another value of t primed and x primed, which is distinct. And so that is the motivation for taking a Lorentz boost of this black string before making the periodic identification. So it is absolutely distinct because you know that the Lorentz boost changes what you mean by the identification. And so what I've written down here, if I look at this metric and then rewrite, if I also identify a new mass, is, I guess I'll take in the sort of rescale my old mass by the Lorentz factor, I get so what I've got here from the perspective of my Einstein frame perspective is something which has some analogies with a Riesz and Nordström black hole. It's something where you've got sort of two roots here or sort of two singular points with the Newtonian potential. But it's different because you've got 1 over the square root here. Now, of course, this is the Einstein frame. I could go back into the other frame, but much of what I'm saying, there would still be this notion that you don't just have 1 minus 2 m on r, you've also got some charge dependence in the metric. So that, you know, that is a different metric to the Schwarzschild metric. I also wanted to say something about a magnetic black hole, but I think it's time to stop. So maybe we can cover that in a tutorial, or I'll see if there's a little bit of time sometime this this week to talk about that. So this is the simplest possible example of Kaluza-Klein theory. What I haven't told you, or haven't what I haven't gone into in detail, is what happens to the rest of the five-dimensional degrees of freedom. All I've done here is I've taken that part of the metric which does not depend on the internal dimension. I've motivated that by saying that the higher order Fourier modes look like masses, and those masses will be very large if the extra dimension is very small. So as far as we're concerned, those modes will not be relevant. But you can go ahead and look at higher Fourier modes, and in that case, the higher Fourier modes of the scalar and vector field actually are all part and parcel of the higher dimensional, what you would interpret as massive gravity or massive spin two modes sitting over your four-dimensional space. So the zero mode that we've worked out here is scalar tensor Maxwell gravity, and then you have a tower of Kaluza-Klein massive gravitons sitting on top of that. But the argument is those have such high masses that they're generically not excited in any reasonable physical setup. So it's quite consistent to just look at this low energy action and to think about what's happening. So this is the Kaluza-Klein way of hiding extra dimensions. The extra dimensions are hidden because they're small, and our geometry does not depend on the extra dimensions. So everything is somehow smeared over the extra dimensions. The Fourier decomposition that I mentioned, that's because we've got a single psi and a circle, you think of it as a circle or cylindrical type of compactification. If you have more dimensions, it's possible that what the manifold you're compactifying on has more symmetries. So with more symmetries, that means you're going to have more killing vectors. And so you, in general, get an A mu for each sort of you get charges associated with each of those killing vectors. So your gauge field or gauge group is more complicated in higher dimensions. But the basic idea is still very much the same. You're making a decomposition of modes which don't depend on the internal dimensions. You're looking for all those possible zero modes that you can have, and then you're forming an effective action. That's what I've done here. I've integrated out over this internal degree of freedom that's not really participating in my four-dimensional gravity or geometry. I've integrated it out to get a low-energy effective action for my gravity in four dimensions. Okay.